don't stop working anyway. Oh, well.
John Mansbridge, reel number one. You were born in 1901. Were there any influences in your family background which contributed to your becoming an artist?
Not at first. Of course, it was in 1903. The WEA was started in the house I was lived in. And, of course, there were a lot of extremely interesting people that used to come. My father was only a clerk, but he had a lot of people who later on achieved distinction in life. There were such people as R.H. Tawney, Bishop Gore, and a man called Henry Clay, who wrote the economic history or something of economics and later became economic advisor to the Bank of England. You know, there were people who started early and were interested in the ideas of the WEA, primarily, that is, of the education for the working man.
Sir William Rothenstein came to the house.
Later. That was when we moved to Hampstead Garden suburb in about 1909, and Frances Cornford, the poetess, was a very friend of my people. She came and made dragons for me in plasticine, and were generally talking, and I'd had some drawings done by, when I was at University College School, a man brought along the drawings. He thought I was very promising. I was only about 8 or 9 then, and he took them to Sir William Rothenstein, and Francis Cornford brought Sir William Rothenstein to our house, and he was anxious for me to start there and then as an artist, but my father wasn't rather keen. He thought I was much too young to start being an artist, and so anyway I went on drawing.
And how did it come about that you went to the Slade?
I went to the Slade really at about 1920, when I was just after the First World War, and already I'd had and been turned down. I knew Eric Gill very well, and he would have made me an apprentice, and I have the letter still in which he said that he couldn't take on an apprentice unless he was prepared to become a Roman Catholic. And as I was Church of England, and my father was very much in the Church of England, I suppose I just waived it at the time. And he didn't approve me going to the Slade, but still I went there.
And what was Henry Tonks' approach to drawing?
Oh, Henry Tonks was, of course, the academic in the finest sense of the word, a living sense. He was very much beholden to the fine drawing, say, of a Leonardo or a Michelangelo, the drawing of the Renaissance. And because he was a unique man, though, because he'd, during the First World War, he'd been doing, he was a surgeon primarily, and he'd been doing face surgery and that sort of thing for men who were badly wounded during the war. And so he had an extraordinary sense of touch. And his great sense of drawing to him was having a sense of, that it communicated a sense of touch to the person, and he was very keen on construction, and he was orthodox in the real sense of the word, a great teacher, very forceful.
Was Stanley Spencer at the Slade when you were there?
Yes, he came to Furbish's drawing up. And often I used to sit next to Stanley Spencer when he was drawing. And in the rest, Model's Rest, he used to come and help one and talk to one. I found him a very remarkable man. And he was sort of the thing which he liked particularly was the drawing of the figure of Piero della Francesca's Nativity in the National Gallery, which he was very beholden to. And really to watch him drawing was absolute education in itself of drawing.
Why do you think he liked so much Piero della Francesca's painting?
He liked the drawing, he liked the technique, I don't know, he was this... I've watched him... if you look at the Stanley, at the Nativity, you'll see how beautifully Francesca's drawn the ankles, and I've watched Stanley Spencer spend a whole morning over some ankles drawing in much the same extremely delicate, searching way.
What kind of art were you interested in when you were a student at the Slade?
Oh, well, I got fascinated with drawing. Drawing seemed to me the major thing. And people said to me I should do composition until I get free and away from the school. And so I did, that developed later on. The pictures and so on. I've done all sorts of things, though.
Were there any European artists that you admired?
Oh, yes. I suppose, well, like all youngsters, one had, fashions of all sorts of people. And I used to really like Picasso in those early years. And Van Gogh and so on.
Cézanne.
And Cézanne. I early on, just after the Slade, I drew Wilson Steer, who used to teach at the Slade. And I said to Wilson Steer about Cézanne's work, and Wilson Steer said to me, he always looks flat to me. But he was very interesting. It was interesting meeting them. And Tonks was... I made an etching of him at his studio, and he was very easy to talk to, and very... he took down a book. Here's a book, he says, I'm sure you wouldn't think of reading, and he says, by Whitehead, and I said, what the... I've forgotten its name now for the moment. Whitehead's... No, I've forgotten. It's about science anyway, and he didn't think I'd be interested in it, and he was, and he was very amused that I could give the title of it. But he was a wonderful man. I remember meeting him on the bus going up to from Chelsea, where I lived at that time, and he was talking about the paintings of Sickert. His friend Sickert, and Sickert was saying how the man, a marvellous colourist who he had thought admirable, was Veronese. And I remember, though, as a matter of fact, Tonks had said to me, he says, there's a wonderful man in the National Gallery, and I said, yes, Veronese. And he says, how did you know? But he was... very good, very interesting group of people at that time. They were, they've passed out of history now, but Tonks and Sickert and Wilson Steer and George Moore. And George Moore, I said to Tonks, I'd like to go and draw George Moore, and he said, well, I'm not going to give you an introduction. You go round, you've got plenty of address, you go and see him. And I went and saw him, had a marvellous afternoon. And of course, he'd been painted 6 times by Manet, which brought you, and he knew all those people firsthand. That was very fascinating. But of course, it's a world which is past now.
What impact did the 1914-18 war have on you?
Oh, well, it was a breaking up time, rather. I was young, of course, in the beginning. I used to have to... I was at Manchester Grammar School at the time, and we I kept the roll of honour because I did lettering rather well, and every day new names of students, you know, boys had died, I had to put on it. It became a fearful document, or a tragic document. But the intermittence back coming back to London and raids and so on, all gave one a sense, I suppose. It was an extraordinary time altogether. I went out for a time to work at Hendon on aircraft, what was called the general erection shop, where we put all the instruments in the aeroplanes and so on. So I was really wanting to go into the Air Force, but I was young, I was only 16 or so, and my father said he'd yank me out, and so I was. Then I went and worked with a man called Emery Walker. Very interesting, because I'd been always interested in William Morris, and Emery Walker had given a lecture once on type, and of course they were enlarged on the lantern slides, enlarged these types of Nicholas Jensen and so on of the Renaissance, and inspired Morris. And that lecture was the beginning of the Kelmscott Press. And a bit later I had my people had some volumes given them at the Kelmscott Press with when May Morris was there, and I still possess them. And they are really extraordinarily beautiful products. But I went over to and spent a day with May Morris, and she took me all over the house, and it was incredible to listen to talking. You know, saying, "Oh, that was done by Uncle Ned, and that was Burne Jones," and then she said, "Gabriel did that," and you felt so in tune with these forgotten people, as it were. Now it's very interesting.
What aspect of Morris's ideas were you particularly interested in?
Oh, I was interested in all round. I like his Dream of John Ball, you know, and when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman. I got very interested because, of course, I'd always been interested in the idea of working men. I mean, I'd been brought up with them. And, of course, I also was interested in Ruskin because, you know, all working men at the beginning of the century were had three books in their pocket. That's the men who were trying to learn things. One, of course, the inevitable Karl Marx. The other was Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe. And the third one was Ruskin's Modern Painters. And it's in the Nature of Gothic, that chapter in that, which was a clarion call to the socialist movement in England. Ruskin's never really been fully understood, I think, really appreciated. He was a very great artist and he was a very great man. And he inspired Morris, of course, very much. I liked Morris and I liked his work and everything else because he was an all-round man. He was a thinker, and he translated the Homer, and he played the Sieger, the Volsung, all that northern literature, and then he wrote his fantasies, and there it is. I mean, it's an extraordinary man. And then there's his socialism. There's been some great men in this last century, really.
Was the position of pacifism, how was that regarded in the 1914-18 war?
Oh, well, there was, of course, the feeling of war and the fighting for the right and all that sort of thing. There was a strong, passionate fervour for a much simpler regard to war altogether, the feeling that there was an evil thing in the world and it had to be fought and beaten. Oh no, it was a psychiatrists hadn't come in their own to complicate the issue so much as later on, but they were very much simpler, and there was an earnest desire, and we lost many friends that way, and even my father, he went into wanted to go in the army, and he got in, and he was shoved out after 3 days because he'd had a spell of cerebrospinal meningitis just before the war started. And but of course he went in and he became a sergeant, and he got wounded very badly, shot through the kidney and so on, in bringing his officer in from the trenches. But of course all this had an influence on me, and I knew lots of people who were fighting and coming home and telling us all their experiences. But somehow it was very life, I don't know, maybe the whole outlook was much simpler somehow than now, and everyone just obeyed and went, you know, to fight for freedom, as it were.
And how did people feel when they came back from the war? They were fighting for a land fit for heroes, but there was great unemployment.
Oh yes, there was lots of difficulties, and it was a very sort of upset sort of business, really. But it was. There's no doubt that there was troubles. But on the whole, I think it was simpler. Because, and even socialism in those days, I mean, the Labour Party was very much simpler. And I remember later I drew a whole lot of the first Labour cabinet, the ministers and so on. It was very interesting meeting them firsthand.
How did you come to draw them?
Well, my father knew many people and he could introduce me to them and so on. And I drew Thomas. J.H. Thomas and Lord Haldane and Trevelyan and oh, quite a lot of them. I forget their names now. I drew all. It was very interesting. And they were very. I wish I'd really. I ought to have stuck to it and got them into a. You know, illustrations. But I never. I was always too. Diffident about my drawing and whether they were good enough, and I always wanted to be better than I was, as it were, and I never could achieve anything, so I never showed very much.
Then, after leaving the Slade, what was your first job?
Oh, I did a number of things. I had some portraits. I remember I did a portrait of a Sir Frank Heath, who was the the secretary for the I've forgotten its name now. Anyway, I remember drawing him and various people I did, and then I managed to do some posters for the Underground, and did quite a whole lot of posters eventually for the London Passenger Transport Board.
What were these posters like?
They were mostly landscapes. And as I'd never painted a landscape, and I landed myself with having to paint for landscapes. But still, they came out very well, and I got a retaining fee with a press called the Baynard Press. There was a very enlightened leader of the head of that press, Frank P. Phillips, who bought works of art and was a very remarkable man in that way. He had a man in charge of the lithography, a man called Griffiths, who wrote a book and was the acknowledged expert on lithography in England. Of course, the Kirwan Press then followed them afterwards, but Fred B. Phillips was all honour to him. He gave a distinction to printing in this country. They get forgotten, though, these names.
When did you have your first teaching job?
Oh, first teaching, I didn't... it so happened I did a portrait of Sam Rabin. It's up there now on the wall, that one over there. And I got a phone call from Clive Gardner, who was then principal of Goldsmiths School of Art, and he said he'd seen my portrait in the Goupil Gallery, and would I come and do teach portrait painting? And so that portrait got me that job.
This was in about 1929, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Let's see now. Yes, it'd be about 1929. No, a bit later. And anyway, I did part-time teaching there, drawing and life and portrait painting.
And do you think your father's concern with adult education affected your ideas about art education?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, beyond the fact that all education would be the growing of the human being, as it were. I always regarded the human being like a plant, and it required nourishment, and by its instinct it would search out and find the right nourishment for its growth. And so I was always rather free and easy about thinking about... I didn't like the academic approach too much.
When did you do the drawing of Charles Gore?
Oh, that was done the number of... when I try to think, I'd have to think it out. It's about... it would be in the mid-20s.
What influence was he on you?
What?
What influence was he on you?
Oh, he was... I suppose I don't know about influence. It's... in those days, he used to live at... he'd retired from being Bishop of Oxford, and he'd gone to... he lived at... it was attached to All Saints Margaret Street. He used to go there, and he had his lodgings just by, and I used to often go and see him in the evenings. And he helped me a lot in his strange way. I mean, you can't put any definite instance, but I'd talk about Dante or something, and then he'd read me Dante in the original Italian and then translate it and all that sort of thing. It was a way of education. In a little before that, I'd been interested enough in making an anthology. That was inspired by Robert Bridges' Spirit of Man, which was an astonishing anthology. And he gave Bridges knew my father, he gave him a copy and so on. Anyway, it worked out. And I tried to make an anthology myself. It sounded rather precocious now. It was called Work and Worship, so obviously I was very much influenced by this sort of thing. But the main point in it was that I read a great deal, and I read all Dante's Divine Comedy, and I made the resolution it would be good if one could only make... well, he'd made an assessment of the Middle Ages, and it'd be good to make an assessment of the of our own time. And I'm very conceitedly and ardently trying to carry that very thing out now in a book.
How did the aims of the Bauhaus affect your ideas during the 1920s?
I didn't know much about the Bauhaus then. The first book I picked up about the Bauhaus was much later, was almost about 1940 or so, when I was in India, in Bombay. I picked up a book on the Bauhaus at the time, and I was buying books. But I'd heard of it, of course, and I'd met Mahalia Nagy as one of the members of the Artists International. And I knew about them, of course, but I don't think they influenced me unduly. And in fact, they had a detrimental influence, I think, on when they changed their curriculum, because they got all the ideas of the Bauhaus, except the fact that the Bauhaus was built by Gropius, who was an architect, and they had architecture. But the English schools left out architecture, the one discipline they might have had. And I think they just went to pieces. I did a book later on in 1969 or so, something like that, on architecture. And by a strange way, it got the notice of Gropius, who said it was a splendid book, but it's gone out of print in England long ago.
This was the book about the principles of architecture.
No, it was called The History of Architecture. A graphic history of architecture.
Yes, it was in visual form.
In visual form. And Gropius approved of it.
Did you join the Artists International Association?
Well, I was on the committee in its early years, right at its beginning, but of course I can't remember the young man who had been to Russia and came back full of it, but he was helped very much by a friend of mine who was on the staff of Goldsmiths called Manner, Freddie Manner, who was a very remarkable man, but he never took any credit for anything. He was always helping people. He was one of the founders of Unity Theatre, and he got me onto the committee of the Artists International, as it was called then. And we had a very interesting committee with Duncan Grant and Vanessa Bell and Misha Black and, a group of people. And it was jolly interesting.
What kind of things did you concern yourselves with mostly? Were you involved in the drafting of the Constitution?
No, not very much. I think it sort of formed itself. It wasn't very organized in those days. Like all these things, they get more and more organized, and then they get disorganized out of existence almost.
Yes, it started in September 1933.
Yes, it would be about then, yes.
Did you take part in their exhibitions?
Yes, in the first exhibition I had a drawing which was reproduced by Herbert Reed in The Listener, I remember.
Can you remember the date of this exhibition?
Well, not at the moment, but I can show her. I've got a sheet. It'll take a few minutes to get it. I've got a sheet of the Listener with the illustration in it. But it'd be about that time.
Early 30s. Did you see Picasso's Guernica when it was exhibited in London?
Yes, indeed. And, of course, I always liked Picasso because he had this... He was so immensely alive. And, of course, I think I'd met Penrose, who was English... Roland Penrose, that's it. He was in camouflage with me. Remember, we used to go to the cinema and we'd see a film and he'd say, Pablo would like that, and so on. But he never understood Picasso at all. None of them did, really, because they always began to try and make him the great man and everything. And Picasso was just a boy. He's alive and he was full of fun. And... I like the fact that he said, I must earn my life. And again, another remark, he wrote very little, but it was very much to the point. It isn't what an artist chooses to do, what matters, it's what he is. You know, he was so sensible about the whole thing. And
what do you think he meant by you have to earn your life?
Well, you have to live and be yourself. Being, really. That's what he'd mean. Oh, no, he was a very great thinker, really. Like so many of the best of the modern artists, Paul Klee or Kandinsky or Mondrian or have you, they all wrote so well. Braque was good. They were all remarkable. They've all said the message which the critics have absolutely ignored. It's incredible.